This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hey, thank you.
Carl Over is a man of few words, except on the page where he is, of course, a man of millions, which are now themselves read by millions. He's the archetypal existential loner hero, only he has four children. He's an intellectual, except most days he'd prefer to talk football. An acutely shy man, he's yet willing to tell readers of the New York Times absolutely everything that happens to him for a week, including the bowel movements. But I'm speaking here of the Carl Over who's made out of sentences. To describe the human man feels to me impossible. Anything I could think to say about him or his many contradictions he's already said about himself. I want to speak instead about his literary provocation as I see it, which is basically to say, whatever is enough. Maybe that doesn't sound very provocative, but in a culture in which people are forever being sold artificial stories about themselves, aspirational stories, political stories, pseudo-philosophical stories, delusional stories, Carl Over stands apart as a writer concerned with the thing in itself. Not the metaphor for the thing, or the simile for the thing, or the theory of the thing, but the thing in itself. Yes, for him, whatever it is enough. And I think this apparently simple statement has had a profound effect both on readers and writers. To readers, his work says, hey, see this life that you're living, with its everyday sadness and smallness, filled as it is with children's parties and beer drinking and disappointing parents and houses and streets and trees and sunshine and rain and buildings and mountaintops. Well, this is also enough. Your life, like mine, is both a great struggle, a heroic drama, and a minor tragedy, just like everybody's. It is both beautiful and utterly banal, both innocent and joyful, nothing but surface, and of a profound and ultimately unknowable vertical depth. To read my struggle is to confront the idea that every one of us is a many-volume book of equal interest and intensity, of equal beauty, although you'd never know that from speaking to the real Carl Over or to any human being. But writing can be the revelation of that fact. And his writing has been for me a kind of revelation. He's helped me to see that everything and anything can be turned into writing. Nothing so shameful as to be beneath writing, and no idea so elevated or complicated it can't be brought back down into a simple prose, clear as a mountain fjord. I want to thank him for that. It's been a true gift to me, and I suspect to many writers. It's difficult to communicate sometimes to non-writers the shame that can attach itself to writing, the sense in the writer that there is something peculiar and unnatural, even violent, in this desire to encapsulate and to describe, to retell and reorganize the chaos of experience into a molded thing constructed from words. The most boring and tautological thing you can say about a writer, that he tells the truth through lying, is at the troubled heart of writing, and despite the cliche, it's fundamentally correct. But normal, happy people don't do that, the writer thinks. They don't lie in order to re-describe or tell the truth. My brother doesn't, my mother doesn't. They are in the thick of experience. They are authentic people as I am not, and they feel no need to describe their lives as well as live them. But then on the flip side of this emotion, there is also writerly pride, the sense that perhaps one is special exactly because of this tendency towards auto-reflection and its external expression. The young Carl Over of Book 5 experiences, like all ambitious young writers, these contradictory impulses simultaneously. The adult Carl Over has taken the shame and pride of writing and tried to transcend them both. The ultimate dream of my struggle, it seems to me, is that the work stops being writing altogether and merges with the things described. This was also Proust's dream and Joyce's and Naipaul's and Dostoevsky's, though each approached the idea in his own mode. It's a dream as old as Plato, at least, who also asked us not to attend to shadows, but to things in themselves. Only our greatest, most shameful and prideful writers attempt this impossible, beautiful, surreal, ultimately doomed attempt to merge writing with the world in itself and to lose the writer in writing. I think Karl Ove is one of these. To become writing itself is, of course, not a thing anyone can do, but he has come closer than most. Ladies and gentlemen, Karl Ove Nausgaard.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I have this reoccurring dream, and it looks exactly like this. It's rather more like a nightmare, because there is a stage, and there is an audience, and I go out there, and I'm standing here, and I'm supposed to sing. And I can't sing, but I have to sing. And then I wake up. I'll read something from book 5 of my struggle. And all you really have to know is that the protagonist is very young. He's 19 years old. And he is a part of a creating writing course, which is a very big thing for him or for me when I was 19, because I wanted to be a writer. And this passage starts at the end of that year when he went there. After we had run through various dramatists and various drama traditions at the Academy, the idea was that we should write something in the genre ourselves, as usual. I put off doing this until the evening before it was due. Then I plodded off to Werfte to sit there all night. We had a standing offer of a desk there if we needed an undisturbed place to write in the afternoon and evening. I had borrowed the keys and done it a couple of times. There was something about being alone in a common room that I liked, perhaps because there was nothing in it that reminded me of myself. I wasn't quite sure why. That was just how it was. Also this evening, when I let myself in and walked through the empty hallway, up the empty stairs, and into the empty rooms at the top. The others had already handed in their contributions. Photocopies of their work lay in piles on the table in the adjacent room. I found a typewriter, put on some coffee, stared at a reflection on the room in the black windows, as though it had been pulled out of the drifting waters of Vågen. It was 9 o'clock. I had decided I would sit there until I had finished, even if it took all night. I had no idea what to write. The coffee was ready. I drank a cup, smoked a cigarette, stared at the image of myself in the window, turned and looked at the bookshelves. They wouldn't have a photography book of scantily clad or naked woman here, would they? But they did have a book about the history of art. I pulled it down and leafed through. Some of the 16th and 17th century paintings were of naked women. Perhaps there was something I could use there. It was too big for me to fit into my trousers, and I didn't want to carry it under my arm, because even though the chance of someone appearing at this time was minimal, it wasn't impossible, and how would I explain lugging an art book down to the restroom? I put it in my bag and went down the spiral staircase and into the toilet. A picture by Raphael stood out at once. Two women in front of a well, one naked, the other dressed. The naked one was strikingly beautiful. She was looking enigmatically to the side. Her small breasts were pert. A strip of cloth covered her nether region. But the thighs were visible, and I got a hard one. I flipped through, stared at a picture by Rubens, The Rape of Daughters of Leucippus, 1618. One of the two naked women was the red-haired, pale, freckly type, with a small chin and a full body. Then there was Botticelli's The Birth of Venus, 1485. where one breast was spared, and Titian, Venus of Urbino, 1538, in which the woman in the foreground had one hand resting between her legs while she gazed straight at the observer with a provocative, self-assured expression on her face. I studied her naked breasts for a long time, her broad hips and small feet. But there were more to see, of course, and I went on to Bartholomeus, Spranger's Vulcan and Maya, 1585, in which the woman, with her hands on a strong-bearded man, thrusts her hips forward with a lustful glint in her eye. Her breast was supple, her skin was all white, her face almost childish. She was good. The next was Delacroix, the death of Sardanapalus, 1827. The woman in the foreground had her back to us. One breast was revealed, thrust right forward, because she had a sword to her throat, and the whole of her bottom was visible, perfectly formed. During this time, as I flipped backward and forward, trying to decide which picture to go for, I moved slowly, holding myself back. Maybe Delacroix? No, it had to be Ingres, Odalisque with slave, 1842. She's lying full length with her arms behind her head and is all wonderful curves. Or, oh, of course, the Turkish bath, 1862. Only women in this one, and they were all naked. They sat and stood in every conceivable pose and every possible type was represented. Cool, passionate, half-concealed, fully exposed. All skin, flesh and female forms as far as the eye could see. But which one? Oh, which one? The one with the chubby face and the open lips. I loved faces in which the mouths were slightly open and the teeth always visible. Or the blonde just behind with the haughty gaze. The one with the small breast staring at her hand. Or the one, oh yes, sitting behind her, leaning back, arms outstretched, eyes closed in ecstasy. It had to be her. Afterward, I stood still for a moment to make sure there was no one in the corridor outside. Then I went back up, returned to the book to its place on the shelf, poured myself a cup of coffee, lit a cigarette, and sat staring at the blank page. Nothing. I had nothing to write. I went for a little walk inside, browsed through the books, went into the photocopy room, skimmed through the others' works. They were what you would expect. Each and every one of them had written in complete keeping with their own particular style. Most I just cast a quick glance at. But I took Petra's into the classroom and read it carefully. It was kind of absurd, almost surreal. Comedy, where people did totally unmotivated and pretty crazy things. It was high tempo, devoid of meaning. My mind impression was chaos and randomness. Surely I could do that too? I began to write, and I wrote quickly. One scene after the other appeared on the paper as a kind of extension of what I have read. There might have been some slight similarities in the characterizations. What they got up to was also unmotivated and unexpected, but it was not a carbon copy of Petra's. Ultimately, the characters did do different things, and I was very pleased when I had a first draft at around 3. I touched it up, went through the whole drama one more time, and by 8 in the morning, I had got so far that I was able to photocopy the text 10 times and put the copies in a pile beside the others. When the first student arrived at 9:45, I was asleep in my chair. The whole day was spent analyzing the texts. I was praised for mine, although Hovland had some criticism regarding its dramatic quality. In other words, the link between the characters and the scenes. I defended myself by saying, there wasn't supposed to be a link. That was the whole point. And he nodded and said yes, but even incoherence requires coherence. The rule of thumb for all writing is that you can write about boredom, but it mustn't be boring. Petra had watched me during the analysis, but she said nothing. Even when Hovland asked her directly for her opinion, she said she had no comments to make. It was only when the lesson was over and people were tidying up and putting on coats that it came. "You copied my text," she said. "I did not," I said. "You were here last night, you read my text, and then you wrote yours. That's copying, pure and simple." "No," I said, "I didn't read yours at all. How can I copy it if I haven't read it? Do you think I'm stupid or what? You sat there, read it, and wrote a variation over a theme. You might as well admit it." "Well, I would admit it if there was anything in your claim," I said. "But there isn't. I didn't read your text, and I didn't copy it. If there's any similarity at all, it's pure chance." "Ha," she said, and got up, put her papers and books in her black bag. "It makes no difference to me. It's all right if you copy what I do, but lying about it, that's not all right." "I'm not lying," I said. "I didn't know a thing until you read for us." She rolled her eyes, put on a jacket, and walked toward the exit. I waited a few minutes for my head to cool down and for Petra to be so far away that I couldn't catch up with her. Then I made my way home. I recognized this situation. It was the same as the one I had been in at school, when I had voted for myself at class rep and received only one vote. And someone found out by asking everyone in the class who they had voted for. I denied it. They couldn't prove anything. I just said, no, it wasn't true. In this case, it wasn't possible to prove anything. No one else but me knew that I had read her piece. I just had to keep denying it. She was the one making a fool out of herself. But I had no great desire to show my face there again. For if no one else knew for certain, I did. The night before, it had seemed natural, a matter of course. I had only borrowed a little from her. Surely that was justified. But during the analysis and in our subsequent exchange, it took on a different aspect. I had plagiarized her work. And what did that make me? How could I become so desperate that I not only plagiarized a fellow student's work, but on top of that, deluded myself into thinking I had made up everything myself? Once I had copied a poem into my diary and pretended it was me who had written it. I had been 12 at that time, and strange as it might be that I could so openly dupe myself. "You wrote this, Karlova, you did," while I had copied from a book. Age was a mitigating circumstance. No, I was 20, though, an adult man. How could I have knowingly done anything so base? For the next few weeks, I stayed at home. I wrote my novel. It was hopeless, but I was nearing the end, and it was important I had something concrete and tangible to show for my work this year. I had sent a text, the one Øystein Lønn had read, to the Kaplan magazine Signale, and one day it came back and nurtured wild hopes of an acceptance as I opened the envelope, but guessed which way the wind was blowing, so it was no surprise when I read, "Dear Karl Ove Knausgård, thank you for sending me your contribution. I read it with interest, but I'm afraid I cannot use it in Signale 1989. Best regards, Lars Saabye Christensen." It gave me a little frisson of excitement to see Lars Saabye Christensen's signature. It meant he had read what I had written. For a few minutes, at any rate, I had filled his mind with what existed in mine. Ecstasy brought out Orange and Lemons. I played it again and again, right until De Lillos released their Hjernen alene, The Brain is Alone. Then that was what was played on my stereo day and night. Outside, the skies were lighter and the rain fell less often. The feelings of spring, which had been so strong when I was a boy, which had filled all my senses and somehow raised body and soul after the winter's heaviness and darkness, overcame me again. I kept at my novel. I wouldn't finish it until the semester was over, but I planned to hand in what I've done as my final assignment at the academy. It was the same novel that had got me into the course, and there was no development evident in it. I wrote in exactly the same style now as I had done then. the whole year has been wasted. The sole difference was that when they accepted me, I thought I was a writer, while now, on the verge of finishing, I knew I wasn't. One evening, Yngve, my brother, and Asbjørn appeared on the steps. "Are you coming out?" Asbjørn said. "I'd love to," I said, "but I don't have any money." "You can borrow some if you want," Asbjørn said. "Yngve has a broken heart, so we have to drink him through it." "It's over with Yngvild," Yngve said, and smiled. "Okay," I said. "Count me in. Hang on a moment." I grabbed my jacket and tobacco and walked to town with them. The next 3 days were a blur. We drank day and night, slept at Asbjørn's, got drunk in the morning, ate in town, continued drinking in his apartment, went out in the evening to all sorts of weird places, such as Uglen or the bar at Rika, and it was wonderful. Nothing could beat the feeling of walking across Torgallmenningen and Fisketorg in the middle of the day, drunk. It was as though I was right and everyone else was wrong, as though I was free and everyone else tied and bound to everyday life. And with Yngve and Asbjørn, it didn't seem wrong or excessive, just fun. On the last night, we didn't know it would be the last. We took cans of spray paint with us. At Hulen, where we ended up, the place wasn't very full. When I went to the toilet, I spray-painted a slogan inside the cubicle. Soon after, a member of the staff came with a cloth and bucket to clean it off. Once he had left, I did it again. We laughed and decided to go the whole hog, spray-paint some buildings in town, and we went out to Møhlenpris. I wrote, "You two stops rock and roll," along a big brick wall in letters as high as myself. They had just played at the rooftop. It hadn't been good. And Bono had formulated the slogan, "You two stops traffic," which was even less good. While Asbjørn wrote, "Ricky Nelson rules okay," over the tram depot wall. And Yngve wrote, "Cat, we need you to rap," on another wall. We continued like that towards his collective, where we stopped to have more to drink. An hour later, we had all crashed out. When we woke up, it was to the fear of what we had done, because the trail led to us. The graffiti started outside Hulen and continued all the way here to the wall beside the door where you could read, "Yngve is a damn..." It wouldn't take much of an investigation to work out where the vandals who had spray-painted the whole of Møhlenpris lived. Especially Asbjørn was jittery, but I wasn't immune. And that was strange, because all I wanted to do was keep on drinking, live the life, not give a damn. Yet I hit a wall whenever I did that, a wall of petite bourgeois and middle-class manners, which could not be broken down without enormous anguish and fear. I wanted to, but I couldn't. Deep down, I was decent and proper, a goody-goody, and I thought perhaps that was also why I couldn't write. I wasn't wild enough, not artistic enough. In short, much too normal for my writing to take off. What had made me believe anything else? Oh, but this was the life lie. What I had learned over the course of the year at the Writing Academy was that there was a literature that was real literature, the true lofty variety, which stretched from Homer's epics and the Greek dramas through the course of history up to the present day, with writers such as Ole Robert Sunde, Tor Ulven, Eldrid Lunden, Kjartan Fløgstad, Georg Johannessen, Liv Lundberg, Anne Bø, Ellen Einan, Steinar Løding, Jon Fosse, Terje Dragseth, Hans Herbjørnsrud, Jan Kjærstad, Øystein Lønn, Svein Javel, Finn Øglen, The Dane, Søren Ulrik Thomsen, Ann Mikael Strønge, The Swedes, Katarina Frostenson og Stig Larsson. I knew that the great Scandinavian poet of this century was Gunnar Ekelöf, and the great Finnish-Swedish modernist Gunnar Björling. I knew that our own Rolf Jakobsen wasn't fit to tie their shoelaces, and Olav og Hauge was rooted in tradition to a far greater degree than they were. I knew that the last great innovation in a novel took place in France in the 1960s, and that it was ongoing, especially in the novel of Claude Simon. I also knew that I couldn't reinvent the novel. I couldn't even copy those who were being innovative, as I didn't understand where the novel's essence lay. I was blind, I couldn't read. If I read Stieg Larsson's introduction, for example, I couldn't say what was new about it or what the essence was. I read all the novels the way I had once read crime fiction and thrillers, the endless series of books I'd read as a 13 or 14-year-old about Black September and Jekyll, about spies during the Second World War and Randy Elephant Hunters in Africa. What has changed during this year was that now I definitely knew that there were differences, but this hadn't had any impact on my own writing. To solve this problem, I had made a subgenre of the modern novel my own. This was the one I marked as my ideal. American novels and short stories written by Bret Easton Ellis, Jane Ann Phillips, J.I. McGurney, Barry Gifford. This was how I excused what I wrote. I had gained an insight, at great expense, but it was real and important. I was not a writer. What writers had, I did not have. I fought against this insight. I told myself I might be able to have what writers had. It might be attainable, provided I persisted for long enough, while knowing in fact this was only a consolation. Probably Jon Fosse, my teacher, had been right. Probably my talent did consist in writing about literature and not writing literature itself. This was my final assessment some days after going on a bender with Ingvar Asbjørn, walking home from the academy after handing in my manuscript. The novel wasn't finished, and I had decided to spend the rest of the spring and summer on it. When it was completed, I would send it to a publisher. I had decided on Cappelen, to whom I felt some loyalty after the personal rejection by Lars Aabye Christensen. I assumed I would get another rejection, but I wasn't entirely sure. They might see something in my writing that Jon Fosse and Ragnar Hovland hadn't. After all, they too had seen something in as much as they had accepted me into the course. This was a small hope, but it was there, and would be there right until a letter from Cappelen landed in my mailbox. It wasn't over until then. The light in the town had been changing character during the spring. The dampness and the gloom of the autumn and winter use were gone. Now the colors were dry and light, and with the white houses reflecting the light, even the indirect light, when the sun was behind the clouds, shimmering and bright, it was as though as the whole town had risen. In the autumn and winter, Bergen was like a bowl. It lay still and took whatever came its way. In the spring and summer, it was as though the mountains folded back like the petals of a flower, and the tone burst forth in its own right, humming and quivering. You couldn't sit inside in the evenings then. I knocked on Morten's door, asked if he wanted to go out with me to Christian, and if so, could he lend me some money? He could, and we perched at the table, staring at all the beautiful girls who were out walking. Not the black-clad intellectual kind, but the nicely dressed, blonde, conventional kind. While we discussed how difficult everything was, and we slowly got drunk, and the evening dissolved into the usual darkness. I woke up under a bush by Lille Lunga Lake, with someone tugging at me. It was a policeman. He said I couldn't sleep here. I got up sleepily and went home. I knocked on Ingvild's door in a new collective. She was surprised to see me, but also happy. I sensed, and I was happy too. It was a big collective with a corner window facing Nygaardsgaten and the Grieg Hall. I said hello to the others living there, faces I had seen but not spoken to, all in some way or other connected with Yngve. Ingvild was fully integrated into student life. That was good to see. At the same time, it made her harder to reach. I was on the outside. She said twice she wanted me as a friend, and I assumed that probably meant she didn't want me as a boyfriend. We sat there on the big sofa. She had made some tea, seemed happy. I looked at her, tried not to show how depressed I was, how sorry I was that we weren't together and never would be. Then I smiled and talked about more pleasurable matters. And when I left, she must have thought it was all over as far as I was concerned, and now we were actually only friends. Before leaving, I asked her if she could lend me 100 kroner or two. In fact, I was flat broke, didn't even have enough money for a smoke. Yes, of course, she said, but I want it back. Goes without saying, I said. Have you got 200? I owed both Yngve and Aspen so much that I couldn't borrow anymore. I also owed Morten quite a bit, and Jan Olav and Anna. I also begged 100 here and 100 there when I had been out of Yngve's friends. No one was that careful when they were out drinking, and I didn't have to pay everyone back. Yngve had 200. I stuffed the money in my pocket and went downstairs as she returned to her room. Strange, I thought as I emerged. I felt the warm air on my face and saw the row of trees that had begun to burst into leaf behind the Grieg Hall. The moment she was out of sight, I missed her. I had seen her only a few minutes earlier. She had been sitting a meter away from me, her knees together and her upper body leaning over the table. And now I was both excited and sad at the thought that she might be sitting alone in her room at this minute, at the mere knowledge that she existed. At the end of May, Yngve had exams, and I joined them in the evenings when they were out celebrating. The town was awash with people. They were everywhere. The air was warm. The trees were an explosion of green. And as I walked around in the evening beneath the light sky, in the dusk-gray streets that never really became dark, all of this gave me strength. All of this lifted my mood. I had such a strong feeling of being alive, and not least, that I wanted to live more. The year was over. The next day, we would be having the end-of-year meal at the academy and be given the certificate, or whatever it was, to prove we had attended the course. I would go, say goodbye to everyone, and then I would turn my back, never think about it again. Among Yngve's student friends, spirits were high. Beer after beer was brought to our table. And even though I didn't say much, even though I was temporarily my silent self, I was still there. I drank and smiled and looked at the others who babbled away about this and that. Ola was the only person I knew. The others I had only seen, so I sat down beside him. He had always taken me under his wing in the sense that he took me seriously and listened to what I said, as though there was something sensible or interesting in it, although he himself was light years above it. He even laughed at my jokes. But I didn't want to impose on him or Yngve, who sat there with his head raised, clinking glasses and talking. By the time the lights flashed and we drank up, then went downstairs to hang around outside until we all gathered as usual, I was so drunk that I felt as if I were in a tunnel. The slides were all dark. The light was only ahead. Wherever I was looking or thinking, I was free. "There's our Kjersta," I said. "Enough already," he said. "It's not funny, even if you think it is." "It is pretty funny," I said. "Shall we get going? What are we waiting for?" Yngve came over to me. "Easy now," he said. "Okay," I said, "but let's move. We're waiting for someone." "Aren't you pleased it went well?" "Of course." He turned to the others. I rummaged through my pockets for cigarettes, couldn't make my lighter work, and threw it to the ground. "Got a light?" I asked the guy who resembled Kjersta, and he nodded, took out a lighter and lit my cigarette, cupping his hand to shield the flame. I spat and took a drag, looking around me. The girls with us were 4 or 5 years older than me, but I was good-looking. Surely this wasn't the first time a 20-year-old had fucked a 25-year-old? But I had nothing to say to them, even when I was as drunk as I was now, so there was no hope there. You had to say something first. That much I had learned. Suddenly they started walking. I followed them, always staying in the middle of the crowd. I saw Yngve's head bobbing up and down a few meters ahead of me. And the luminous May night with all the smells, the animated voices, all the other people on the streets, my brain was whirring with thoughts of how good this was. I was a student in Bergen, surrounded by other students. We were off to a party, walking through the streets of Høyden toward Nygaards Park, which lay still, breathing quietly in the darkness between all the roads and buildings. It was 1989. I was 20 years old, full of life and energy. And watching the others walking with me, I thought, they weren't like that, only I was. I rose higher and higher, farther and farther, while they stayed where they were. Fucking media students, fucking media brats, fucking media theorists. What did they know about life? What did they know about what was really important? Listen to my heart beating. Listen to my heart beating, you dozy fucking little imbeciles. Listen to it beating. Look at me. Look at the strength I got. I could crush every last one of them. And it wouldn't be a problem either. I could just go on and on and on. They could belittle me. They could humiliate me. They always had. But I would never give up. It wasn't in my makeup. While all the other idiots who thought they were so damned clever, they had nothing inside of them. They were completely hollow. The park. Oh, Jesus, the entrance to the park. Oh, shit, how beautiful. The dense green foliage, nearly black in the gathering dusk, and the pond, the gravel and the benches. I took it all in. It became me. I carried it within me. They stopped. One of them pulled out a bunch of keys from the trousers pocket and opened a door to a detached house on the opposite side of the street from the park. We went up an old battered staircase, entered an old battered apartment. There was a high ceiling, a fireplace in the corner, rag rugs on the wooden floor, 50s furniture bought at the flea market or at Fretex, the Salvation Army shop, a poster of Madonna, a poster of Elvis with a gun that Warhol had done, and a poster of the first Godfather film. We sat down. Spirits and glasses appeared on the table. Yngve sat at the head of the table. I sat at the opposite end. I didn't like having anyone close to me, as you had on a sofa. I drank. More darkness. They discussed. I threw in comments. Yngve sent me occasional glances, and I could see he didn't like what I said or the way I said it. He thought I was showing him up. Let him think that. It wasn't my problem. I got up and went to the toilet. I pissed in the sink and laughed at the idea of them putting in the plug, filling the sink with water and washing the faces the following morning. I went back, poured more whiskey. Almost everything was dark now. Look at the park, I said. What about it, someone said. Easy now, psycho, Yngve said. I dragged myself to my feet, grabbed my glass and hurled it at him as hard as I could. It hit him in the face. He fell forward. Everyone got up screaming, rushed to his side. I stood still for a moment and watched the scene unfolding. Then I went into the hall, put on my shoes and jacket, and staggered down the stairs, onto the street and into the park. The feeling of finally having acted was strong. I looked up at the sky, which was light and bright and wonderful, and stared into the green darkness of the park. And then I was gone. It was as though I had been switched off. I woke up on a corridor floor. It was light. The sun was streaming in through the windows. I sat up. There were several doors along the corridor. An old lady stood eyeing me. Behind her, a younger woman, perhaps 40. She was eyeing me too. They didn't say anything, but they looked scared. I struggled to my feet. I was still drunk, my body laden. I understood nothing. It was like being in a dream, but I knew that I was conscious and staggered off down the corridor, a hand against the wall every now and then. There was something about a fire engine. A fire and a fire engine, wasn't there? At the end of the corridor, there was a staircase. At the bottom, a door with frosted glass in the top part. I went down the stairs, pushed open the door, stopped it outside, and squinted into the sun. In front of me was the end wall of the science building, To the left was Lille Lunga Lake. I turned and looked at the building where I had slept. It was white and made of brick. A big police car came down the road and turned into the gravel area in front of me as two women came out of the door behind me. Two officers walked toward me and stopped. "I think there's a fire," I said. "A fire engine went that way," I said, pointing across. "It's not here. It's further away. It must be." "That's him," said a woman behind me. "What are you doing here?" one policeman said. "I don't know," I said. "I woke up here. But I think you should hurry." "What's your name?" I looked at him. I teetered to the side. He put his hand on my shoulder to steady me. "What difference does it make what my name is?" I said. "What's the name?" "You better come with us," he said. "In the car?" "Yes, come now." He put his hand on my arm and led me to the car, pushed open the door, and I got in at the back, a large space which I had all to myself. Now I had experienced this as well, being driven through in the streets of Bergen in a police car. Had they arrested me? But it was the end of Jærmil today. There were no sirens wailing or anything. They drove sedately and stopped at all the traffic lights. They arrived at the police station, grabbed my arm again, and led me into the building. "I need to make a telephone call," I said. "It's important. I should be at a meeting. They had to know I won't be coming. I have the right to make a call. I know that." I was laughing inside. This was just like a film. Me, flanked by two policemen, asking to make a telephone call. And I got my way. They stopped by a phone at the end of the corridor. I didn't know the number to the writing academy. There was a telephone directory underneath. I tried to look it up and failed. I turned to them. "I give up," I said. "Okay," they said, and led me to a hatch where I had to empty my pockets and hand over my belt. And then they stared me down to the cellar or whatever it was. At any rate, there were iron doors on either side of the corridor, and I had to go through one of them. The cell was completely bare except for a big blue mattress. "Sleep it off here. Someone will collect you for questioning when you wake up." "Yes, sir," I said in English, standing in the middle of the cell until I had closed the door behind them. Then I lie down on the blue mattress and laugh to myself for a long time before falling asleep. The next time I woke up, I was still drunk, and everything that had happened out there and on the way here had something dreamlike about it. But the iron door and the concrete floor were tangible enough. I knocked on the door. I ought to have shouted, but I didn't know quite what. "God?" "Yes." "God, I'm waking up," I shouted. "God, God." "Shut up," someone shouted. That frightened me a bit, and I sat down on a mattress. Afterward, the door was unlocked, and a policeman stared in at me. "Are you sober now?" he said. "Yes, I think so," I said. "Perhaps not completely, though. Better than before, anyway." "Come with me," he said. We went up from the cellar, him first, me next, into an elevator and through the floors. He knocked on a door. We went into an office. An older man, maybe 50, maybe 55, plain clothes, looked at me. "Sit down," he said. I sat down on the chair in the front of his desk. "You were found in Florida," he said. "You'd fallen asleep in the corridor of a nursing home. What were you doing there?" "I don't know," I said. "I was so drunk. I don't remember a thing, just that I woke up there." "Do you live in Bergen?" "Yes." "What's your name?" "Karl Ove Knausgård." "Have you any convictions?" "Convictions? Have you ever been convicted of anything? Drugs, breaking and entering?" "No, no, no." He looked over at a man standing in a doorway. "Will you check that?" The man went into the office next door. While he was there, the man who was questioning me sat, head down, filling in a form without saying a word. Blinds covered the windows. Outside, between the slats, the sky was blue. The second man came back. "Nothing," he said. "You don't remember anything?" said the man questioning me. "Earlier in the evening, you don't remember anything? Where did you go?" "I was at a party by the park." "Who were you with?" "My brother, amongst others, and some of his friends." He looked at me. "We better call him in then." "Who?" "Your brother." What's he got to do with this? And what is all this about? I slept in the corridor of a nursing home. That's not good, I know. And you might consider it breaking and entering, but that's all I did. You don't remember anything, he said. The home was burgled last night, and in the immediate vicinity, there was a car crash. So things were happening. Then we found you in the corridor of the same home. That's what this is about. What's your brother's name? Yngve Knausgård. His address and yours? I told him, you'll be hearing from us. You can go now. I was escorted down to the ground floor, given my few possessions, and I went into the parking lot outside. I was so tired I could barely walk. I stopped several times to catch my breath, and before Steinkjellergaten, I had to sit down on a step. I simply had no energy left. Up the hill, would I make it? But 10 minutes later, after the passers-by had stared at me, every single one, I got to my feet and lurched up the hill. The walk home from the police station took me close to an hour. In my room, I lay down on the bed and fell asleep for the third time within 24 hours. Not for long. When I opened my eyes again, it was still early afternoon. The heaviness had left my body. It felt normal now, apart from a terrible hunger. I ate 10 slices of bread and cheese, drank a liter of milk with Nesquik, and went to the phone booth to call the academy. Fortunately, Sagen was there. I told him I had been arrested and I hadn't been able to go to the dinner. Arrested? He said. Are you joking? No, I said. I spent the night in a cell. I'm still in a bad way, I'm afraid to say. Could you send me the certificate, do you think? Certainly, he said. Shame you weren't here for a meal. Arrested, you say? Yes, I said. Thank you for everything this year anyway. I'm sure we'll meet again. I hung up, and with my last coins, I caught a bus into town. The sky was dark blue, the sun red, and above Askøy, the clouds in the east looked as if they were on fire. I walked past the student center and down to Møhlenpris, intending to visit Yngve. Perhaps he could clarify what had happened. The door was open, and I went up the stairs to the floor where the collective was and rang at a bell. Lina, a nice blonde girl from Østlandet, a few years older than me, opened the door. She looked at me with something akin to fear in her eyes. Is Yngve in? I said. She nodded. Come in, she said. He's in his room. I went in, took off my shoes, kept my jacket on, knocked softly on Yngve's door and opened it. He was standing by the stereo and turned when he heard me. I stared at him in amazement. Half his face was covered with a bandage. Suddenly it all came back to me. I had hurled a glass at him with all the strength I possessed. I had thrown it in his eye. He didn't say anything, just looked at me. Did I do that? I said. Yes, he said. Don't you remember? Yes, I do know, I said. Did I hit you in the eye? Are you blind? He sat down on the chair. No, the eye is intact. You hit me just next to it. I had to have stitches. There'll be a permanent scar. I began to cry. I didn't mean it, I said. I didn't mean it. I don't know why I did it. I didn't mean it. Can you forgive me? Yngve, can you forgive me? He sat like an emperor on the chair in the room, his back erect, legs apart, one hand on his knee, looking at me. I couldn't meet his gaze. I couldn't look at him. I lowered my head and sobbed. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
That was great.
Okay, can I? Yes.
Hi. When I was coming through the airport, I went to the bathroom and I heard a woman saying to a friend, "What kind of a person even says that out loud?" And I thought, I'm going to go meet him now. I know exactly who it is. There was a bit in the section you read, and I liked it particularly when I first read it, where you say, I couldn't reinvent the novel. And you know, the shame about the idea of not reinventing a novel. And I was thinking that you have substantially now, or you've done something damaging and transformative to it. And I was trying to think how to identify it exactly. And in this volume, more than any others, I thought the project becomes clearer and clearer. And there's a lot of stuff in it about surface and depth. There's a lot of images of surface and depth. And I was thinking that all writers, when they're trying to change a novel, are trying to get rid of some version of what they consider to be surface to reach the depth. And sometimes the surface is something like polite society or middle-class life or nationhood. But in your version, I just wanted to read two lines. You say, "What was consciousness other than the surface of the soul's ocean? Other than small, brightly coloured boats, floating plastic bottles and driftwood, waves and currents, whatever the day might bring, over a depth of several thousand metres." And I thought, I couldn't remember a novelist who had thought that consciousness was the surface. Consciousness is the stuff that novels are made out of, usually. And I wondered if shame is the thing that you're bringing up from the depth, or is shame, that's the purpose of shame in these books, to try and get deeper.
I'm a very intuitive writer, you know, and the freedom of this book was that I just could write. I could just, you know, do it as I, the best I could, but I could just write. So there was no thought of reinventing or doing anything new at all. And I don't think I have, but I think I got kind of close to myself. And being so close to yourself, I don't know what shame is. My first novel I wrote, it is not a self-biographical novel, but it has lots of elements, of course, of me in it. And my editor wrote the text on the back, and he said, he called it a monument of male shame.
Right.
And I said, what? What do you mean? I wasn't aware of the book was about shame, because I am so full of shame, and that was the way I thought the world was like, you know? But I'm very interested in shame, because that's the point where kind of the outer world and the social world enters the inner world and inner self. And that's what's at stake in this book, is the division between the inner and the outer. And the shame is the outer world, you know, being inside of you.
Right.
And I come from a kind of a shame culture, I think I can say. I've been talking with this with my mother, who is the same. She's very shameful and very proper. I mean, she is very decent. Mm-hmm. She's never done anything wrong in her life, and that's because she's so full of shame.
Right.
And she told me about her mother, and she was kind of... She was also very...
To come from a long line of ashamed people.
Yes, cultural thing. But I think shame is a good thing. Yeah. It is. It keeps you in place, and it keeps you, you know, you have to... It's a way of respecting other people somehow. It's a way of... You know, but too much of it is dangerous almost, because it restricts you so much. You know, the man I was reading about there is, you know, he's exploding. That's because it's taking everything in, and shame on everything. So you hardly can move, hardly can maneuver.
But what interests me, just from the process of how it was written, is I do believe you that it's intuitive, but there's so much art theory hidden in it. And I wonder what comes first. Like, for instance, the bit you read, the masturbation scene, which is so incredible, this shameful confession of putting a book down your pants, going down to the bathroom. But inside it is also the idea, like, quite challenging to art theory, that art isn't a separate place, that it's part of the human, that a beautiful picture by Titian could also be used for an erotic purpose, which was always... I mean, we're from the similar generation... academically, and I remember those arguments being made about art and art being separate from the erotic realm. So I think a lot of writers wonder how conscious it is when you're passing through these clearly theoretical arguments.
Many of those are... Yeah, because when I went to university, and it was all about art being, as you said, what's the word in English? Is separated or, you know. And I believed in that, and I read about that, and I was thinking my own writing in that way and so on. But when I wrote this book, it was like a very liberating act.
Yeah.
And it was like coming back to myself how I was before I started to study. And this scene, it did happen. I remember it very well.
Yeah.
But it's still, when I wrote it, it's of course funny just because of that, because a way of taking art completely down, you know, to the lowest level. And it does belong there,
too. Yeah, it belongs there. Yeah. It reminds me of that, you know, like that Terence quote, "Nothing that's human is alien to me," which I think during that period in the 80s, 90s of theory madness, it disappeared, no? And also the idea that language was reality. There was nothing else but language. And and that argument, first of all, made books that were very concerned with their language, you know, this very elaborate language.
Yeah.
And your books seem to me to be making this ancient argument that there is something outside of language in people.
Yeah.
Something that can't be contained by language. And so the language is kept like that surface of a pool.
Yeah.
Very, very plain.
I just read The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson, and there's a beautiful quote there in the beginning of the book. She's quoting two Wittgenstein quotes.
Yeah.
And the one is the famous one that, you know, what you can't talk about, you have to be silent.
Right.
The other one is that what you're talking about, what you can't say, is contained inside of it, you know. And I think that's the hope, and for everybody who writes, that's what you want, you know.
Right.
Just hoping that it will be something there, because there is, the representation is, you know, it's really is, you know, that there is so much that can't be represented. And there is, yeah. If you read most advanced poets, it's like they are, you know, at the, and this is a very banal thing, but it, like they are at the end of the language, and kind of you can look into life, how life really is, you know. And I think the whole academic way of thinking is, you know, to isolate thinking, isolate objects. It's not like that at all. I mean, we are accepting everything, even you know, reading Adorno or whoever. We have you feel something, but all the feelings are just separated. And that's a very conscious thing in the book, that these things are the same. It is possible to think about, you know, Adorno when you are buying things in the supermarket, or it's like they exist at the same level.
And also to name emotions with their most simple terms, which I think was really difficult to do for a kind of intellectual generation, to say I am sad when I'm sad. Or sometimes there are moments in the text where there's just almost a primal cry. It's just ooh or ah.
Yeah.
Things that it would have seemed impossible, at least when I was young, to write down.
That was the hardest part of writing my struggle. It's because having been, you know, studied this at university and having read all these books and having this as an ideal, my ideal of good writing, that's, you know, the death of Virgil.
Right.
The first page is there. It's so good, you know.
Yeah.
And having that as an ideal and then writing this, you know, just down there, it was so hard and so shameful.
It's the risk of looking like an idiot.
No, yes,
this
exactly.
Is it.
And that's
it's a huge risk.
That's the risk.
It's
risk. And that's what, again, with you know, university, that risk of being laughed at is eliminated. Because there is a language, you don't laugh at that language, you know. But doing this thing was very risky and very dangerous. And I felt this is so bad, you know, all the time when I was writing, exactly because of that, you know. But at the same time, it was true to me somehow. So it was a big...
But then how do you feel about... character, because I know from talking to you in other circumstances that there are lots of novels that you love that are very different in style from your own, have a different perspective. But here and there in book five, the idea of character, as in not the self, not the I, but everybody else, is questioned. There's a page where you say, the young Carl Levy says, why write about why so-and-so divorced so-and-so or hurt somebody else or why have these situations? What's the point of them? And I wondered about that because in this perspective, characters exist only in the way that they affect you, no?
Yeah.
They are like emanations. They make you feel sad, they make you feel happy. Or do you believe it's possible to write fiction from the other perspective where characters are in some sense separate from the world or separate from the narrator?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think... I think, to be completely honest, I think that's the greatest art, to make that happen. I do think so. I think it's much more easy to write about yourself or you know, from that perspective. So a novel like, you know, Madame Bovary, for instance, is very good. And if you
it
read,
is quite good, yeah.
Yeah, and if you read, if you read his letters,
yeah,
which I did a few years ago, they're obscene. They're very direct.
Yeah,
they're
like kind of Joyce too, no?
Lots yeah, of... and it's like that is his life, and yeah, it's very much alive. And but it hasn't the relevance that his book, his letters is like backstage, and this yeah, book is like, you know, something different. It's a kind of crystallization, and I think that's the.
But at one point, Carl Over charts a journey between early Joyce, like Stephen Hero, where the character is separate from the story, up to Ulysses, where the story, it's beautifully put, like streams through the character.
Yeah.
And then to Finnegan's Wake, where language streams through everything.
Yeah.
And is that your ideal, that arc, that you end in that place where language is streaming through everything? Because you haven't gone, that's not where these books go.
No, it's not. I have gone in the opposite direction, tried to make something very small and, you know, separated from everything. I've done that for a year now. But I have a very good friend of mine. He's a novelist. He's a Norwegian novelist, and he's probably the best Norwegian novelist for a couple of generations. But it's impossible to translate him because his language is so innovative and specific, you know. And he's wild. I mean, it's really, really wild. And I was interviewing him once for a magazine, and he said his idea of the perfect novel was that, you know, we start here, and then you go on, come to different places, and you go on. And then, in the end, kind of the book should be on Chinese, and the reader should know how to read Chinese just by reading it, you know. And that's the kind of ideal, the change things, you know, that things just happen and it goes on, and you are at a complete different place.
Yeah, I'll do that next time.
Yeah.
That's my plan.
But he has the wildness has a common with Joyce. Joyce was also very wild. And that's the good thing about him, I think.
I want to ask you a little bit about children and language, because I was thinking about the idea of our real selves or some deep version of ourselves not being represented in language. I always feel it most extremely at a dinner party. You know, everybody's talking. I'm sure you all have it, right? And you have this deep despair that you're entirely unrepresented as a self at this dinner party. It's just people are talking. And you want it, so like a primal scream goes on inside. But when you have children, I just become very aware, having them, that you are part of the original sin. You know, you're creating language for them, you help them make it, and you see this kind of wild thing become a citizen and a person. And I just wondered what influence having children had on your ideas about making a person, the relation between language and a self.
No. Yeah, that's, you know, that's a very good idea for a novel. it's almost unbelievable to see, you know. I have this young daughter, she's 2 now, but it's just, you know, a year ago she couldn't talk, she didn't say anything. And now the other day she was waking up and she shouted to me, "Dad, the moon." You know, it was such an amazing moment, because then she's situated in the world and in history and, you know, all of humanity in those two words. And so I feel like language is very strongly, when I was writing this book too, that it doesn't belong. We feel strongly that the language is mine, you know, it's me, but it isn't. It's just something we grow into and die away from. And my children speak Swedish, you know, that's very strange too. They can't speak Norwegian, can't speak my language, you know. I have no idea. I had another experience with children and language. My oldest daughter, she came over to me and had written something and she wanted me to read it. And it was opening of a novel. And she's like 12 and it wasn't that it was so good, I was amazed, but it was the experience of what she was writing about. I couldn't imagine that she was experienced this, you know. So I had to Google it to see if it was really her that had written it before I went in to talk to her. But it was
family
like...
Family plagiarism. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but then, you know... the thing was that she had showed something completely different than she shows, you know, in every other... And that was through language, somehow. And language for me is a way of escaping, mostly and basically. And this is all, you know, also exploring, finding out things. Language is defining the whole world, you know. So if you have a different language, your world is different.
Would you consider it a good sign if your children wanted to be writers? I mean, how do you feel about writing now? There's so much fury and sadness and shame about the whole practice in this book, but has it brought you some joy now at this end?
The writing?
Yeah,
it does, yeah. It's, but I think, before I thought if they want to be writers, that I've failed, you know,
right,
as a father.
That's what I think, yeah.
There's no other reason for them to write.
So then something's gone very wrong.
Failure.
Yeah.
But then I was also thinking, but maybe that's good. I mean, maybe not the ultimate goal is to be, you know, happy, having a good life. Maybe the whole thing is that you have a troubled,
right,
difficult life.
Exactly.
Living it, you know, like full.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the thing. But then again, I don't want that for my children.
Right.
I want them to be happy.
Yeah.
But you can never know. I mean,
but that's interesting to me, the uses of happiness. When people have children, they're so preoccupied with this idea of a happy childhood. And yet all of the things they admire, the art they love, the music they listen to, come from exactly the opposite experience. Like, we have no language to talk about the uses of misery.
No.
Well, maybe you found one here, actually. I want to ask you also about music, because a lot of writers have a sentimental feeling for music as exactly the thing which is beyond language, maybe, and has some more direct relation to that depth inside us.
Yeah.
Is that how you feel about it? Would you, in an ideal world, would you rather have been that drummer? Actually, I don't know if drummers have a special insight into depth, but a musician generally.
No, I wouldn't. I have to be honest. I couldn't imagine anything else than to write, really.
Right.
But when I was, you know, 16, 17, 18, I really wanted to do it. But I think musician, I think that's, yeah. It's such a... it's so much about presence. And my life is so much about not being present,
right,
you know. So it's... yeah, it's a good...
But I think a lot of, like, young writers, young people, they look at you and think that the thing which you've achieved is the creation of that writerly ego. You are a writer, that is your identity. But my sense about you and about the books is that it was escaping that identity and that idea which allowed you to write.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's quite hard to explain. I mean, with my students, I find that hard to explain because everything on the surface looks to be the opposite. They just consider it a hypocritical position. But it is true somehow.
Yeah, I think so. That was the meaning of the last sentence of the book. That is, you know, that I'm so happy that I no longer are an author.
Right.
And that was the thing. I wanted all the books to end there because this is a book about, you know, life and literature and writing and all of that.
It's so counter to an American idea of what identity is meant to be. It's not meant to be freedom from a persona. It's meant to be having a persona,
yeah,
having an identity, or having a very specific way of describing yourself.
Yeah, but I think we started this by talking about shame, and that's kind of a key here, isn't it?
Maybe Americans seem a bit less full of shame. Is that fair to say? Maybe a little bit.
I don't know.
Well, the shame is deeper. Maybe everyone has the same amount of shame. But there's a pride in the sense of being a person. And here we have 600 pages of cringing at the idea of being a person.
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking, has writing them brought you the freedom that the book seems to be so obsessed with? Freedom from being thinking of yourself as a person, wondering what other people think of you, all of the ways we construct ourselves?
Yeah, a little bit it has. But not, you know, in not very much. Not in my personal circumstances, it's exactly the same. It hasn't
right.
liberated anything.
Right.
But it had liberated other things. And what I discovered there is that, you know, it's easy to write. And that was kind of a discovery. So now I still work very, very, very much. I'm like a workaholic. And I do that, of course, because I want to escape from something.
Right.
So I use writing to get away from myself, and I've always done that. And that's a good reason as other reasons, I guess.
And can you have any relation with the other end of it, with the reader? Like, do you think about your effect on them, or writing as a gift to a reader, or can you not think about readers at all?
I can't think in those terms myself, but when I meet readers and I can see they are affected, I mean, people can cry when they meet me because there is something my books have evoked in their life,
right.
And I want to tell that to me. Then that's the best thing that can happen to a writer, of course. But I never think of the reader when I'm writing. That's impossible. I guess you don't do that either.
I think sometimes of the reader, but it's a crippling thought. I try not to have it too much. I love readers, I mean, but, you know, not when I'm
working. That's afterwards, right?
Yeah. I remember when we first met, I think at that point you were saying, and we decided that you would not write again after these books. The opposite has proved true. Do you know why?
When I stopped writing, it was very hard to do it, and I did it, you know, I wrote very much, so I was relieved for like a few days, but then it was like a sorrow, you know, like I've lost something, like I was almost like someone was dead. And I don't know what that is, but I think it is, you know, the state of selflessness. I remember I heard an interview with Anne McEwen, and he used that word, that's the gift when as a writer, there is a certain selflessness in the writing, and I think that's the thing I want, you know.
Yes.
Not to be aware of myself, not to be, you know, it's almost like it has nothing to do with me at all, it's just a state of mind where you are. I don't know what you is, but you are.
I read a line by, I think it's Josh Rothman at New York, which I thought, I've read a lot of people writing about these books, but he said this beautiful thing, I thought, about an autobiography written not from the perspective of the person writing it, almost. Like, not in sympathy with oneself. Like, when we write about ourselves, usually we're on our own side, trying to present a certain picture, trying to defend ourselves against attack. And that's what's unusual about it, that on the one hand, you have this autobiographical, apparently narcissistic project, but somehow the self isn't in there. There's something similar happens with Dylan, though, for example. Thousands of words, but no Dylan in there.
Mm.
That's not a question, I'm sorry.
No.
What else do I have to ask you? I don't know. One thing. My husband wanted me to ask, and it's the most boring and stupid question, but it bothers both of us. When you sit down, I tested him. I said to him, can you remember Tuesday, 1997, you know, May 5th? Give it a go. And it's so, try it yourself. It's so hard to do that his argument is that the entire thing is fiction in the same way we write fiction. It's a fictional, unless you're going under some kind of meditative moment. You place yourself in the room, think of the carpet, think of the walls. I mean, there are moments here when you see a drop of ink or a piece of coffee on a table, tiny elements. How is that done?
Yeah, it is done exactly as fiction is written. It's exactly the same thing. It's like, I have been writing fiction, and I have been writing, you know, about memories, and it's the same kind of processes. But the details are, of course, invented. I mean, the coffee things are invented. But the thing is that when I start to write about things, it's like it comes more and more comes back. So,
like when you get the logo on somebody's T-shirt, are there moments when it feels? Well, it's just your brain telling you one way or another. No, your brain could tell you this is a fictional detail, or your brain could tell you, oh, he was certainly wearing the Coke T-shirt.
Yeah. An interesting thing is that nobody protests about the details.
Oh, really?
No, they don't. But they do protest a lot of what they was been saying or what the situation was really like when it's present. But when the further you go back, in a childhood book, there's no protest at all. They all, you know, accepted everything.
Like false memory syndrome, like you've...
Yeah, but that's also a subject in the book. It's like there's a lot of doubt about memories all the time and that they're deceiving you and, you know, you're inventing things to protect yourself, and I know that happens.
So is there something... a little violent about being the victor of the family memory system. Like most of us in families, it's a constant battle. You meet for Thanksgiving, someone remembers one thing, someone remembers another. But if you've published 6 volumes,
yes,
you win that argument. Or you replace them. Do you think you've done that in part? That they're a version, your version, like the child's desire to have their version.
Yeah, because when you it's fixed, that's the thing.
Right.
Normally it's just, you know, floating and... But I have to say, my father's family, they kind of... they said, you know, straight out that this, you are lying, this right. didn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And being in this zone where you don't really know what's memory, what's invented, and this was related to my father's death,
right.
which is, you know, that was the reason for the book to be written, and they said, no, he didn't die that way. He didn't die in a house full of bottles. There were maybe a few bottles,
right.
but it wasn't like that. He was perfectly healthy, and he died of a heart attack. And his grandmother was, you know, it was completely the opposite of the book. And I started to doubt it, you know, more and more. And there was also this element, have I used my father to, you know, used him and added something to make myself interesting and to write a good book?
Right.
That's also a possibility, you know.
Because it's that feeling throughout the book of like a Dostoevsky and like you've killed someone. At one point you say, it's not like I killed someone. And there's a kind of disconnect between your guilt and what's actually happening. Nothing so shameful is happening apart from your version of your story is being told. I thought that maybe all of us feel a bit like a Dostoevskian murderer if we say, this is what my family was like, against everybody else's counterversion.
Yeah. No, but there is a lot of guilt in the book, of course. And I do feel like I've killed someone. And there is a transgression writing about other people. And it is terrible. And I won't, you know, advise anyone to do it unless you really, really, really have
hate
to.
Hate your mother, yeah.
Or hate your family, yeah. But I didn't write bad about them, you know, but I wrote about my father and his faith. But then, this is the irony of this book, because this is about literature and life, was that while I got these letters, and this was also public, this was just an invention, I got a letter from one of the persons that she said, you know, I was sitting reading a book about a house and a dead person in the house, and I realized I have been in that house. She was the one who entered with the ambulances, you know, to my father. And she wrote to me and she described it and she said it was even worse than your descriptions.
Right.
And it was like, you know, it was such a relief because I really, really, really doubted myself and what I'm doing. And it was terrible. And I put that in book 6.
Right.
And then I haven't heard from anyone.
Oh, really? Transformation.
But it doesn't mean it was good of me to do it, because it wasn't. But it's still, I wasn't, you know, inventing it. It was true somehow.
To write requires some kind of risk, and that's the risk of these books. Personal risk as well for you. We're out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.